Hello, it's Wednesday the 24th of November and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. South Korea's COVID-19 case count has hit a new daily high of over 4,000 cases, and the number of critically ill patients reached a record of 586 as well. We'll have more in our news briefing shortly. For our in-depth today, we'll be discussing the K-pop phenomenon BTS and how the joy of winning the top prize at the American Music Awards was quickly tempered by missing out on the major Grammy nominations this week. Plus, on Korea Book Club, we look at a short story collection that delves into the rich history and harsh realities of the Korean film industry. We'll have all that and more on today's Korea 24. South Korea has logged a new record in daily COVID-19 infections, surpassing 4,000 for the first time since the start of the pandemic. The number of severe cases is also inching closer to 600. For more on this and our other headlines of the day, we're joined in the studio by KBS World Radio news editor Eunice Kim. Hello, Eunice.
Hello, Jang-woo.
So, Eunice, another unfortunate milestone reached. Can you run us through the numbers?
Yeah, we're seeing rises on all three indicators. The KDCA is saying the country logged 4,115 cases throughout Tuesday. Seoul alone had 1,729 cases, and yes, that is a record high, while Gyeonggi Province had 1,176. Nationwide, the death toll was the highest since the fourth wave began in July at 34. That was revised from 35, as reported earlier, as one of the deaths was identified to be a stillborn fetus from a 24-week pregnant woman, a first fetal death for the country. She, the mother, had been unvaccinated and was confirmed with COVID 4 days prior. The number of critically ill patients, meanwhile, hit a fresh high of 586. That is 37 more than the previous day. Prime Minister Kim Buk-yeom, in a disaster response meeting on Wednesday, said the spike in new COVID-19 cases in the greater Seoul area is critical enough to consider an immediate emergency plan for the region. He said the phased recovery that was launched amid much difficulty is facing its first crisis and called on the public to continue cooperating on masking, ventilating, and testing. He also asked people with mild cases to recover at home in order to free up hospital beds for those with serious cases.
In fact, authorities are now actively considering taking emergency measures. And that, Eunice, could mean suspending the transition into living with COVID-19 in the capital region, right?
Yeah, so the government had planned to conduct a 2-week evaluation of the first phase of this transition that began earlier this month, November 1st, before advancing into the second phase, which was about earmarked for mid-December. But it appears that timeline could see a temporary pause. A government civilian committee tasked with preparation for the transition is set to convene its fourth meeting on Thursday to discuss the details of reinforcing quarantine. Now, with the occupancy rate of beds for critical patients surpassing 80% in the capital area, authorities are also planning to ease restrictions on ward density, and they are also looking to tighten rules for admission to ICU units to give priority to those serious cases for the time being.
Yeah, so we'll keep our listeners updated on the situation over the coming days. Turning to other headlines now, South Korea has decided to join the U.S. and others in releasing reserves of crude oil in a concerted effort to stem rising global oil prices. Can you tell us more?
Mm-hmm. The South Korean government late Tuesday announced this decision apparently at around the same time Japan, China, India, and the U.K. Did as well in joining this U.S.-led initiative. Seoul said the need to coordinate globally on the swift rise in oil prices as well as its alliance with other countries were reasons for its decision. The size, timing, and method of release, though, are to be discussed later, though the government said it will likely be decided at levels similar to the past. Now, South Korea had released 3.47 million barrels of oil back in 2011 during the Libyan crisis, and that did account for some 4% of its crude reserves then. The Korea National Oil Corporation said the country had 97 million barrels of crude reserves as of the end of August.
Meanwhile, it's official. Samsung Electronics has chosen Taylor, Texas as a site for its new semiconductor manufacturing facility. What more details can you tell us?
So Samsung Electronics Vice Chairman Kim Gi-nam made this announcement that it has decided to choose Taylor, Texas for this $17 billion plant. It is the largest ever investment that Samsung Electronics is making in the U.S. It will build a new semiconductor fab site and produce advanced chips applicable in mobile 5G, high-performance computing, as well as artificial intelligence. Taylor will serve as a key location for Samsung's global semiconductor manufacturing capacity, along with its Pyeongtaek production base, and contribute to the stability of the global semiconductor supply chain, according to the tech giant. Taylor is about 25 kilometers away from Austin, Texas. That is where Samsung has another chip plant.
Moving on, a five-day funeral is ongoing at Severance Hospital in Seoul for the late former president dictator Chun Doo-hwan. Despite it being the second day, few high-profile politicians were seen coming through to pay their respects, Eunice.
Right. According to local reports, which cited the hospital staff, about 300 visitors had come through on Tuesday, many of whom were Chun's contemporaries, including his close confidant and ex-national security chief Chang Se-dong. Former ministers Park Cheol-eun and Kim Yong-gap had also visited the funeral altar Wednesday morning. Also there was former UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who said history will evaluate the deceased and that he came to receive the lesson that unfortunate events of history should not happen. He added it would have been better had Chun Doo-hwan shown penitence as No Tae-woo had before him. There were flowers sent by the PPP leader, Lee Jun-seok, as well as jailed former presidents Lee Myung-bak and Park Geun-hye, but the only incumbent lawmaker to visit was the PPP's Yoon Sang-hyun, who was Chun's son-in-law.
The number of babies born in the nation slid 6.7% on year in September, posting a decline for the 70th consecutive month. Can you tell us more?
And it was the sharpest drop to be posted this year, according to Statistics Korea, who on Wednesday said a total of 21,920 babies were born in the nation in September. That is nearly 1,600 fewer than the same month last year. The figure is the lowest to be posted for the month of September since the statistics agency began to compile data in 1981. It also extends an on-year decline in the number of newborns to 70 back-to-back months since December of 2015.
And finally, K-pop group BTS managed to snag one nomination for the 2022 Grammys, but they were snubbed in top categories that the group had been favored for, Eunice.
Yeah, fans and non-fans alike were eyeballing the coveted Record and Song of the Year categories, but with its announcement of nominees on Tuesday, the 64th Grammy Awards revealed that BTS was passed for those categories, but was nominated for Best Pop Duo Group Performance for their hit song, Butter. It does mark the second consecutive year that the group was nominated in that category with Dynamite last year, so fans are crossing their fingers that 2022 perhaps will be the year they actually win Best Pop Duo Group as a start.
Well, we'll be talking more about this next, but for now, that is where we leave it for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates, Eunice.
You bet.
When it was announced on Sunday that the K-pop sensation BTS had won Artist of the Year at the American Music Awards, it was hailed as a milestone achievement, a sign of a major breakthrough in the US music industry. But the celebrations were short-lived, as just 2 days later, the nominees for the highly coveted Grammy Awards were announced. And although the boys picked up their second consecutive nomination for the Best Pop Duo or Group Performance category, They were once again snubbed for the major awards, such as Record of the Year and Song of the Year, despite the huge success of their single Butter this year. To get reaction and analysis on these announcements, we have joining us on the line now Dr. Kim Young-dae, esteemed music critic and author of the book BTS The Review. Dr. Kim, it's great to have you with us today.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So BTS once again did not score any nominations in the major categories for the Grammys. That's despite Butter being the year's top-selling song in the US, topping the US Billboard Hot 100 chart for 10 weeks. So, Dr. Kim, what was your immediate reaction to their exclusion?
Well, first of all, what I want to say is that they never failed. I mean, they didn't fail. I mean, we're talking about the Grammys like any other award show in Korea casually. Well, of course, it could be a great thing in itself, but the Grammy isn't that simple. It's really a hard award to beat. I mean, there are numerous gates guarded by many different gatekeepers, culturally, racially, and so on. So as an Asian musician and Korean musician, and also as a pop artist, BTS already broke through that door and has been nominated, like you said, for 2 years in a row. So it is historic itself. As you pointed out, and many have already pointed out, unfortunately, BTS was not nominated for general field, including Record of the Year. It's a pity, but I want to ask this. When did it become kind of taken for granted, right? I think it's already a historic achievement they made. So personally, I believe it was pretty close, almost there. Again, it's a pity that they were nominated for general field, but they were nominated for pop duo or group, which was really hard category for Asian artists. And it's the second year in a row. So it's safe to say Korea now have two-time Grammy nominees artists. So it's a wonderful thing.
Sure, of course it's a wonderful thing, and we shouldn't consider this a failure. But there is a frustration among the fans that despite BTS having one of the biggest songs of the year, they still couldn't make it past the gatekeepers, as you've called it. Why is that? What do we know about the nomination process, and why did BTS not make the cut?
Oh, well, first of all, there are many different people from different cultural backgrounds with different races. So we cannot, it is impossible for us to pinpoint what's the real reason, what's the real, you know, background. And they're not one people, right? They're kind of like a group of different people, different backgrounds. It's hard for BTS to be nominated, especially in the general category, because they don't have any like racial or cultural advantages. They're Asian artists, so well, most of the voters are white, you know, male, you know, middle aged. So they would normally don't have many access to Asian music or many knowledge or any like positive opinions on the Asian music itself probably. And when African American people, they would normally favor like R&B and hip hop. So I think in that sense, BTS has definitely disadvantages to be nominated in the general field. But again, they were nominated for a pop duo group, and pop is pop, you know, pop stands pop music, and it was usually nominated, they usually included white male pop star, but BTS is now one of them. So I think it's a great sign for a better future. I think it's almost there once again. Yeah.
The Recording Academy says it doesn't take sales or chart positions into account when picking possible champions. So some might argue that BTS's songs just didn't meet perhaps the artistic standards that the voters might hold. Do you think that argument holds water?
Well, artistic standard, it's a hard, you know, this difficult word to define because, well, Recording Academy says that they would not, they don't, you know, consider like popularity, but in a way they did, right? Because there are so many songs with less fame, but they would normally choose you know, well-known songs because they're humans. They would normally listen to the song that already known to the public. So in a way, they're right. They would not consciously consider, you know, the songs that are popular, but they kind of automatically choose or include a song that's popular. So it's a might be double standard. It's hard to tell, but I think it's a kind of limitation of this kind of system. The whole results are determined by the small group of people, and with a limited cultural, you know, diversity.
Sure, but perhaps there was particularly high expectations for BTS to pick up a major nomination because just a couple of days earlier, they had won the top prize at the American Music Awards. They were crowned Artist of the Year there in a list that included industry heavyweights such as Ariana Grande, Drake, Olivia Rodrigo, Taylor Swift, and The Weeknd. The group also won two other awards, a favorite pop duo or group and a favorite pop song with Butter. First, let's look at how significant that was to win Artist of the Year. And then second, why could they win that huge award there but then not pick up any major awards at the Grammys?
Well, to put it simply, there's a kind of the generational change of the face of pop music, or the icon of pop music, has taken place in American pop music, American Music Award. American Music Award normally known for more audience-oriented, audience-friendly or popularity-friendly award, because the whole result was determined by the votes of the audience, of the fans. So, well, I think a lot of people nowadays had a hard time to accepting the aspect that it's actually changing. The face of pop music is actually BTS right now. Well, before, in the past, American and British music industry always made the icon, but they haven't been able to create a big pop group after, like, Jonas Brothers or One Direction. And BTS now emerged as the worst, probably most popular group, the biggest group. So this award, American Music Award and Artist of the Year, is a symbolic moment that proves that. It is not simply the success of Korean or Asian artists for me. It's a historic event for even for American pop music, because they never allowed other pop stars from outside would take that crown, right? So that event that is actually, for me, the one that shaped the order of pop in a way. But again, the nature of the award is pretty different. I mean, Grammy is a whole different show, and they're normally very conservative, in other words, they are really slow to adapt, and it's really hard to appeal to a lot of, like, different people, especially older generation voters in the Grammys, to accept that this newest trend. So I think in popularity aspect, popularity-wise, I think AMA kind of more directly reflect the newest change. And the newest change that is BTS is now the icon of pop music.
Right. Despite that landmark achievement to win Artist of the Year at the AMAs for BTS, this Grammy snub perhaps frustratingly has overshadowed it somewhat. Why do you think the Grammys continues to stay so important for artists despite the criticism that it perhaps gets? And secondly, how important is the Grammys to BTS and what they want to achieve as well, though?
Well, for a lot of people, including myself, Grammys, the oldest and most prestigious award, because they are the first serious award, in the music industry. And the thing is that the Grammys are determined by the insiders would make this award even more important. The acknowledgement, the reputation among the insiders, record producer, composer, the artist would mean a lot to the artist themselves. So I think in that aspect, the history, the nature, the barriers, the fact that they would not consider the popularity makes this award special and different from other awards. So, I think in that aspect, it's definitely the prestigious award, but at the same time, it could be least relevant award among all.
Mm.
Because they really are slow to adapt.
Right.
Yeah, the newest trend.
I'm sure fans though would still perhaps want that recognition for BTS. What would it?
Right.
What more would it take for BTS or perhaps any other K-pop artist to be nominated for a major Grammy? Or is it perhaps time that the Grammy has to reconsider how it considers its nominees?
It's hard to tell. I mean, slow and steady, what else can I say? It's not really about the music itself. It's not about the quality of music or strategy. I think the world and the music industry are already changing. And we are actually in the middle of that change now. So I would say water does not boil to a certain temperature, right? So I think that day was not really far away.
Well, BTS were nominated for the Best Duo or Group Performance last year, but they lost to Lady Gaga. Do you think they will win it next year?
Yeah, I think they would win. But probably the... Doja Cat, a lot of great musicians are in the competition. It depends on how the committee members would think about the distribution I don't know, direction of this year's Grammy Awards. Or they would, if they believe BTS has to get one of them at least, it is high likely that this one would goes to BTS. But if they would believe that certain artists would dominate, you know, all the categories they would be nominated, I think it would be a difficult game.
And finally, do you think BTS will get a major Grammy nomination one day?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a matter of time. I think the accumulation of the fame, recognition, and the reputation would all kind of be contributing the result. And they're doing pretty well. I mean, they actually did everything they can do right now. So I think it's up to Grammy. it's their game to win or their game to lose for me.
Sure, BTS, I'm sure, will keep knocking on the door and keep breaking down the barriers. Meanwhile, the 64th Grammy Awards ceremony will be taking place on January 31st. We'll see if the boys still does make history again, actually winning the Grammy for Best Pop Duo or Group Performance this time. We've been speaking to music critic Dr. Kim Young-dae. Dr. Kim, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index fell 3.04 points or 0.10% on Wednesday, closing the day at 2,994.29. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ rose, however, gaining 6.41 points or 0.63% to close at 1,020.13. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 3.21 against the dollar, ending the day at 1,186.51. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
We move on now to our daily segment, Korea Trending, where we round up some of the other news stories that have also been attracting attention online in Korea today. And it's the turn of Walter Lee to bring us those stories. Walter, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello, Jung-ho. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. So what stories do you have for us today?
Okay, so we'll discuss a series of reforms the government has devised for curricula in elementary, middle and high schools. We'll also find out where some of the remains of the nation's first ordained Catholic priest will be enshrined. And finally, we'll talk about the heroic deeds by ordinary citizens that saved the lives of two people.
Okay, so we start with some major education reform plans announced today. Can you tell us more?
Yes, so the Education Ministry on Wednesday announced a package of reform measures for curricula in elementary to high schools, which will be finalised next year. Starting in 2025, high schools in the country are set to adopt a credit system, currently on a trial basis. Under such system, students will be able to select courses they want to take and graduate after fulfilling a required number of credits.
Right, before we get into the details of the reforms, can you tell us why the government has decided to try and bring about such changes?
Well, the reform measures mainly seek to introduce the selective curriculum at elementary schools and further strengthen career education at middle schools. The ministry said that they're aimed at fostering students' knowledge and capability in responding to social changes such as digital transition, climate change, and population decline.
Okay, then. So how do they plan to achieve this? What kind of changes to the curriculum are in the works?
Well, starting in 2023, the course load at high schools will be reduced from the current 204 units to 192 credits, or by 170 hours. Mandatory credits will be reduced from 94 to 84, while selective credits will increase from 86 to 90. For middle schools, the government plans to introduce in the second semester of third graders classes centered on helping students choose their careers ahead of entering high school. The selective curriculum will also be introduced at elementary schools from 2024. Another major change for elementary schools is the classes for first and second graders on what the schools call fun activities. We'll see their hours jump from the current 80 hours to 128 hours. The government is apparently aiming to add more outdoor and physical programs tailored to younger elementary schoolers.
Yes, the changes to the elementary school curriculum have perhaps been the most eye-catching, even controversial, but it showcases the changing attitudes, to the education system in Korea. It'll be interesting to see how these plans are implemented and the impact they have over the next few years. Okay, let's move on. What's our second story about?
So some of the remains of the nation's first Catholic priest, St. Andrew Kim Dae-gon, will be enshrined in Burkina Faso, West Africa. On Tuesday at the Catholic Archdiocese of Seoul, Cardinal Andrew Yom Soo-jong, the Archbishop of Seoul, delivered a vessel containing the relic to Monsignor Julian Cabor, who is a counselor of the Apostolic Nunciature in the Philippines. The remains will be enshrined at the Cathedral of St. Joseph of the Archdiocese of Kupela, which was newly built with funds raised by members of the Yeouido Parish of the Catholic Archdiocese of Seoul.
Okay, so just to give a little background for our listeners, Kim was ordained in 1845 and became the first Catholic priest in Korea, but was persecuted, then executed for practicing Christianity the following year. He was canonized as a saint by Pope John Paul II during his visit to South Korea in 1984. And now a part of his remains are set to be enshrined in Burkina Faso, I guess. I'm sure many listeners will be asking, why Burkina Faso, though? Can you explain a bit more for us, Walter?
Yeah, so Kobore, who's from the West African nation, previously conveyed to Yom his wish to enshrine some of Kim's remains in the Cathedral of St. Joseph, as this year marks the 200th anniversary of Kim's birth. Kobore is said to have been deeply moved by the history of the Korean Catholic Church's martyrdom while serving in a post in the Apostolic Nunciature in South Korea.
I see. So Kim's story is set to be shared to more people halfway around the world then. I understand that actually various events have been held in the Korean Catholic community from November last year to celebrate the anniversary of Kim's birth.
Yeah, that's right. So the Catholic Bishops' Conference of Korea had declared the period from November 29th of last year to November 27th of this year a jubilee in honour of the 200th anniversary of Kim's birth. In the Catholic Church, a jubilee year is marked every 50th year or 100th year to celebrate an important occasion. During the jubilee honoring Kim, the Catholic community raised some 6 billion won, that's over $5 million, through vaccine campaigns and delivered the funds to the Vatican to assist its endeavours to offer vaccines to the socially vulnerable.
Yes, it's great to hear that a lot of good work is still being done in Kim's name. Let's move on to our final story now. What do you have for us?
Yeah, so our final story is about ordinary citizens coming to the rescue of two people trapped inside a burning vehicle in Busan's Jung District. According to the Busan Metropolitan Police, on Tuesday, a sedan suddenly rammed into the middle guardrail in front of the Yeongju Tunnel at around 5:40 p.m. last Sunday. The car's engine soon caught fire, with the driver and passenger losing consciousness. That's when a taxi driver and a driver of a ladder truck broke the car window and pulled the unconscious driver out, and soon after, another citizen began to administer CPR. A fourth citizen then called 119 and sought to rescue the other passenger in the vehicle, which by this point was engulfed in flames. The two employees of Yeongju Tunnel Management Office helped put out the flames with extinguishers installed near the tunnel.
Wow, so dramatic scenes indeed. So was the rescue attempt a success then?
Yes, thanks to the heroic deed of the courageous citizens, the driver and the fellow passenger were safely rescued and are said to be receiving medical treatment. An official of the Busan police said that the six citizens and others who have yet to be identified are true heroes, as they saved the lives at a time when a major car explosion could have occurred. The Busan Metropolitan Police plans to deliver letters of appreciation to the six citizens and the others who took part in the rescue.
Yes, the whole incident was caught on CCTV cameras and shared by the Busan Police, which has further attracted attention to this story. It shows how quickly and bravely these people acted to help those in the car. Well, it's certainly a great story to end our career trending today with then, Walter. Well, thank you for bringing us those stories, and we'll see you again later this week.
See you next time.
Welcome back. It's time now for our weekly segment, Korea Book Club. And already it's the final Wednesday of the month, which means instead of looking at Korean works of literature in translation, we're taking a look at more recent bestsellers and popular books in Korea that have not yet been translated to get a sense of the current literary scene. And we do that with our monthly special contributor for the club, literary translator Anton He, who is with me now in the studio. Anton, hello. It's great to see you again.
Hello, Chang-ho. It's good to see you too.
So what book have you brought for us this month then, Anton?
So today's book is Towards 0% or 0%를 향하여 by the author Seo Ije, published by Munji Books.
Okay, so it's a collection of short stories, actually, but it's the title story Towards 0% that was something of a sensation when it was first published, I believe early last year, right? And so we'll be focusing on this story today the most, as it is the representative story from the collection. So with that in mind then, Anton, can you tell us more about this story, what it's about?
So the title story, which is a little long for a short story, was indeed talked about as a favorite read among aficionados of contemporary Korean literature. And it was anthologized in the quarterly 소설보다 series from Munji, who published the three best short stories of the season every season. And Towards 0% is the story of a young woman who is thinking of quitting the Korean film industry. And it's also the 100-year history of the film industry at the same time. A her story and a history, if you will. It starts off with mentioning the Best Picture Cannes Palme d'Or win for Parasite, and noting that it happened almost right after the centennial of Korean film, or right on the centennial of Korean film, actually, if it's the Palme d'Or. As the main character, a young woman downtrodden by the terrible realities of the Korean film industry, reminisces about her experiences, good and bad. She also inserts details about the 100-year history of Korean film, which started on November 27th, 1919, with the film 의리적 구토, which translates into something like loyal revenge. Guto here refers to revenge, not nausea. There's also mention of the legendary Taehan Cinema in Piccadilly, places I actually watched movies in and now no longer exist. And the first woman to direct a feature film. And astonishingly enough, there's a little bit about the future of film as well.
Right. So the story is about the Korean film industry, more specifically about the dreams and realities facing workers in the world of Korean film. It's interesting because actually Anton, you and I, we exchanged some tweets recently about the smash hit series Squid Game and how Netflix seemed to have produced it for a bargain compared to American-made productions, and our concerns about what that means for how little gets trickled down the production ladder. What can you tell us actually about the realities facing labourers in the Korean film and TV industry?
Indeed, we did discuss this, and I remember your suspicions were confirmed only a couple of weeks later in a survey conducted by the Hope and Solidarity Trade Union, or 희망연대 노동조합. This workers' union's broadcasting staff chapter surveyed 330 workers in broadcast television, and the results were disheartening. Most crucially, only 20% of production crew members reported signing proper work contracts. Of those who were working without contracts, 77.5% of them were told this was due to the broadcast or production company's insistence on normal practices, quote-unquote. Crew are also expected to work almost 20 hours a day. Less than 10% of crew surveyed reported working less than 12 hours a day. And one of the ways these companies get away with these practices is to use turnkey companies and subcontract the work to them, minimizing their own responsibilities under Korean labor policy. Clearly, this is a sector that is in need of labor reform. Note that the most lucrative film industry in the world, Hollywood, is also the most unionized film industry in the world. I'm just saying.
Yes, so it's within that backdrop that the story is set, the story we're talking about today, and how the characters are struggling with that situation. How does the story play out then? Is it all doom and gloom? What sustains the characters throughout the story?
There are many beautiful moments in the story, and I think it's these moments that really make the story so appealing to so many readers. There's a section where the narrator describes watching an independent film for the first time, for example. She's a high school student at the time, and she's never seen an indie film in a theater in her life. Somehow, she learns there's an interesting movie being shown in an art house theater, and she has to go all the way to another city to see it. So she lies to her parents, pretending she's off to study or whatever, and hops on a bus to go to this art house theater in another city where she happens to be the only person who shows up at the showing. If you've been to an art house theater in Korea, this is a very common experience. To this day, she still remembers how quietly magical the whole experience was for her, and this experience is repeated at the end of the story, where she is invited to a very special showing of a movie made by an old woman who has always wanted to direct her own film. Ultimately, this is a story about dreamers, and the history of Korean film is a history of Korean dreamers.
I feel like you have experience perhaps sitting in a theater by yourself, an art house theater. It sounds like you're a film aficionado as well. You talked about how there are historical details about the Korean film industry that the story goes into detail about. How is that weaved into the narrative?
Yes, there are so many details that go in and out of the main narrative, which is the story of the main character. To reiterate, the first Korean film was released in November of 1919, making 2019 the centennial of Korean film. There are many movies and directors mentioned throughout the story, but I was especially affected by a brief description of the cinemas in Jongno Samga Station and all the theaters where I have actually been in. For example, I saw Sex and the City 2 with 14 other gay men at Dansongsa, which we took out a whole row. And that theater, which survived the Korean War, has not survived the beginning of the 21st century. There's also the story of Park Nam-ok, the first female movie director of Korea, who put together an entire film from financing to post-production, apparently carrying a baby on her back the whole time. This was the first and last movie she ever created, and it was taken down from theaters after just 3 days of being shown. And her memoir stated, quote, "I love film, but I'm not sure if I want to die for it." And the story is filled with wonderful historical details like this one, as well as the narrator's serious and hilarious thoughts about doing film in Korea.
Sure, this sounds like a love letter to the Korean film industry as well. So we've said this story was a sensation of sorts when it was first published. Can you explain for us why that was? What is it about this work that works and strikes a chord with people?
I think it's the narrator's struggles that really strikes a chord, because she is doing something that she loves. And we're always told that, you know, if you do something you love, then you don't have to work another day. But she really goes into the detail of what they have to pay in order to do the thing they love. So they don't get paid. They have to pay to do it. They have to pay in terms of their time, their effort, their sanity, their youth, definitely. And about the people who fall out along the way and the possibility of them coming back, whether she will give up doing what she wants to do or whether she will keep on going somehow and find a way to do it. And she describes, you know, the different kinds of like exit routes that other people have taken that are kind of film adjacent, but have nothing to do with film and the film production in the classical sense. And so as a literary translator working in the literary world, there are a lot of things that are familiar with her struggles. Mm. And I believe that Seo Yi-jae's experiences in the film industry is probably informing her emotionally, not just in terms of content, but emotionally as to how it feels like to be a writer, how it feels like to be a director. You know, I feel like they're very similar things.
Sure. It's about expressing how, I guess, the people who have this passion, despite all the pressures that push on them in their lives, that whether they can let go or can't let go of their dreams, and about their struggle with that. So we focused mostly on the title story because of how popular it got when it was first published. But what about the other stories in this collection? What can you tell us about them?
So I think what's most notable about Seo Yi-jae's style is perhaps the fact that she herself was a film student. And this shines through in her work, not just in terms of content, like Towards 0%, but in style as well. I think it was last year's National Book Award winner, Interior Chinatown by Charles Yu, which also experimented with scripts as prose or prose as movie scripts. And Seo Yi-jae just makes every story kind of like an art house flick. And it's very pithy and visceral and just stylistically just very refreshing to just read her stories. A kind of fun thing that she also does is that she doesn't use quotation marks for her dialogue. And all of the dialogue are kind of like in one paragraph where there are no line breaks. It sounds horrible if I say it like that. But it's actually really cool because you are not confused at all at who is speaking when, because all of her voices are just so clear. And she's such a good a dialogue stylist, basically. And, you know, her dialogue is just so vivid and true. I think she's definitely a talent to watch out for, and her book is a must-read for anyone interested in that most 20th century of art forms, which is film and literature as well.
This collection comes at a time when Korean films and TVs are enjoying unprecedented global success, and that could mean many people outside of Korea would be interested in reading this as well, especially the title story. Is it being translated into English, do we know?
Yes, the book is not, but the story specifically is.
Right.
It's going to be published as a chapbook by Strangers Press in the UK, precisely because of those reasons. I'm editing that series right now, and I got to pick 8 stories that will appear in the series, and I really wanted this story because it's just so Korean, not just in its content. I mean, of course, it's very Korean in its content. It's about the Korean film industry, and everyone seems to care about the Korean film industry now. But also, just like the emotions expressed in it, the kind of persevering despite difficulty, and the kind of ironic humor and dark humor that goes into those situations. I think that this is becoming more of a Korean situation. If you look at Squid Game, it is a very scary kind of horror kind of vibe going on, but it's also kind of funny in places. And there is a lot of humor in it as well. And I think that's kind of like what makes it emotionally a very Korean cultural product. And I think this story kind of fits right into that vibe.
Well, perhaps the depictions of the working conditions is perhaps not the best advertisement for the industry, but I guess it does perhaps showcase the creative passion that seems to lie within the Korean psyche, even amid economic and social pressures. Gives a little insight into that world. Once again, it's called 0%를 향하여, or Towards 0%, by Seo Yi-jae, and that was our special monthly pick for Korea Book Club. Anton, thank you for introducing us to that work, and we'll see you again next month.
Thank you so much. See you next month.
This is Scott Kelly, former NASA astronaut, and you're listening to Korea 24.
We finish up the show with our closing segment now, Morning Edition Preview, looking at some interesting features or reports are coming out in tomorrow's English language newspapers here in Korea, namely the Korea Times and the Korea Herald. Joining us now is our staff editor, Mark Wilson Chair, who's been looking through those papers for us. Mark, hello. Hope you've been well.
I'm doing great. Thanks for asking.
So where are we headed to first?
That would be to the People's section in tomorrow's Korea Times. Jung Da-min has a cool feature on architect Lee Jun-hyung, who has an ongoing project aimed to improve the quality of life for those who live in one-person households in Seoul. We actually talked about that earlier, about the increase of one-person households. Maybe our listeners remember. Called the Project Hwam, it creates an expansive shared spaces in Hwamdong in the capital's Yongsang district. And according to architect Lee, a resident of Hwamdong himself, the main idea of the project is about building a structure that houses like a village inside. He told the Times that people can dine in one area, then read books in another, then watch TV in another, and so on. And because single-person households are so isolated, I've lived in many myself, such areas, they don't exist for people like us, or when I used to be that kind of person. So this project is aimed to fix that.
Right. You have to actually go out yourself and kind of find your own communities rather than having one available to you right in front of your door. So an internal village, essentially, this complex is sort of making. The space allows people to do, I guess, all sorts of community activities then.
That's absolutely right. Since it's first launched in he first launched a shared space in 2016, it was a communal kitchen. The project is running spaces like a library, a living room, exhibition studio, a baking space, a spa-like area, and a townhouse space, just all these different spaces. And judging by the images in tomorrow's Times, these community areas, they aren't just your typical rec centers. They aren't just these big kitchens with the metal sinks and just the, you know, you're trying to wash your dishes. It looks like the interior of a home, right? So if I were a first-time resident of Hwam, I think I would be hesitant of just walking inside and asking around, like, can I really use this space as a community area? So I think you should pick up tomorrow's Times to see these pictures for yourself.
Right, I guess it's like the first time you use a college dorm or something. You're quite not sure of the rules about what you're sharing and what space everyone is using.
Right.
It's interesting. As you said, the single-person households in Korea is on the rise at a very fast pace. So this asking a lot of questions about, you know, how we're going to live like that as a society. And it's a challenging how we deal with that situation. So, yes, and this architect, it looks like he's trying to figure out and help other people figure that out as well. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to our second story then. What do you have for us?
We're headed to the culture section of the Korea Herald. Song Seung-hyung has a piece on a documentary on ethnic Koreans who neither identify as South or North Korean, but as people of Joseon. Zainichi are ethnic Koreans who moved to Japan mostly during the 1900s, before the Korean Peninsula was split at the end of World War II. Mm. Titled I Am From Joseon, the film centers around the first generation of Zainichi, and from what I read about it, it doesn't pull any punches and immediately delves into the discrimination and outright xenophobia towards this group of people in Japan, a lot of it being directly aimed at Joseon schools, which were established to preserve Zainichi culture and Korean culture and heritage. So yes, that means that many times it's the children that bear the brunt of such xenophobia.
Yes, it's a painful situation, but a rich topic, really, for a documentary to really delve into. Can you quickly tell us about the inspiration behind why he decided to make this documentary?
Sure. It happened when the director Kim Chul-min met Zainichi for the first time in 2002. He was taken aback about how little he knew about their history and culture, and honestly, Jung-ho, reading this piece, I realized how ignorant I've been. I've actually met Zainichi before, and initially I was like, oh, this is Japanese Kyopo or Japanese Korean, but it's different, man. Mm. It's different. These are Joseon. These are Zainichi. So director Kim, he emphasized at a recent press conference that it was vital that he make such a film to spread historical information to people, especially Koreans. And notice how he said Koreans, not just North and South Koreans, right? So I Am From Joseon won the jury award at the 2020 DMZ International Documentary Film Festival, and it will hit local theaters on December 9th.
That sounds fascinating. As listeners who want to find out more can check out tomorrow's Herald. That is where we leave it for Morning Edition Preview. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Mark, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Talk to you then.
And that's where we wrap up our show today as well. Thank you for staying with us. We'll be back same time tomorrow, so do join us again then. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and as always, thank you for listening. Goodbye.
PBS World Radio.